Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Welcome to Mortal and Strong, the podcast. I'm Dr. Liz Murray, founder of this project, where each episode we will be sharing one interview from one of the voices from our project. Presented by myself and Laura Middleton Hughes, each episode will feature one voice, someone sharing their story of overcoming major medical problems early on in life, to share a message of strength, hope, and resilience to others. To learn more about the project, please visit our website, www.mortalandstrong.com. And now for the latest episode.
Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Mortal and Strong. I'm Laura.
And I'm Liz.
And today we're joined by the lovely Viv, who is talking today about her diagnosis with secondary breast cancer. She was diagnosed de novo. And it's all about how her husband, and her two beautiful girls have navigated life over the last few years. So thank you, Viv, for coming.
Thank you for having me.
So we're going to go into the interview, how we've been doing so with everyone we've had. And the first thing is a little quick fire round just to get us warmed up. Okay. So, handmade card or shop-bought card?
That's a new one.
Shop-bought, but with my own words in.
Fabulous. Holiday abroad or here in the UK?
Abroad.
Reading or television?
Television.
Be rich or be famous?
Rich.
Do you prefer karaoke or dancing?
Karaoke.
Oh, love a bit of karaoke.
Not that I'm any good at it. The
whole point of karaoke is you're not very good at it. Live in a big city or in the countryside?
Countryside.
Musicals or plays?
Musicals.
Skinny chips or fat chips?
Ooh. Skinny chips.
Hot dogs or burgers?
Burgers.
And short nails or long nails?
I bite them.
So short
nails.
Snap. Welcome to today, and thank you so much for joining us on the sofa. So we're going to go right back to the beginning before any diagnosis. Tell us a little bit about who Viv was at that time, what you were up to, and where you were in your life.
So I was married to Nigel, two daughters, Alice and Jess. They were at that time sort of teenagers going into, both of them were actually at university just before I was diagnosed. I'd had a long career as a nurse. For the last decade of that, I worked actually as a nurse in women's health. And my last role was actually as a fertility nurse specialist, okay. Which, you know, was a very, very rewarding. I loved that job very much. We also have, my husband and I have a stone slate roofing business, so very different from nursing, with a slate mine. And I've always done the admin and office side of that. So nursing was kind of the biggest part of my life, but then I did that as well. So it was sort of part-time at each. Life was busy, but very good. I was very happy. Happy and busy, yeah. Loved life.
How long ago was it then that life changed and what happened?
So it was in June 2020, so at the height of COVID.
Right in lockdown.
Right in lockdown, when I think right out of the blue, I was in the bath and I noticed a rash on my breast and then some dimpling. I couldn't feel anything at that stage, but then when I got out of the bath and had a really good feel, I could feel something hard in the breast, so immediately panicked. Even though it was, at that time, it was COVID times, to be fair, I got an face-to-face appointment the next day with my GP. I kind of knew from her reaction that she felt it was...
Do you feel because you had the nursing background, you sort of know how people give the game away, if that makes sense?
Yes.
Yeah. A little, you can read people
yeah,
more.
Yes. And also because it felt hard and okay. and solid. And I just feel like I knew at that stage.
Let's ask, how old were you at the time? And also, were you in a habit of checking regularly or?
So I was 50 then. I was almost 51, so I think it was a week before my 51st birthday. I hadn't been called for a mammogram at that stage. I knew I'd be invited that year. And you think, well, I'll get that, you know, the invite will come through. And I actually got my first call for the mammogram a month after my diagnosis. which was in the August. But
were you checking regularly?
I did check myself, but I didn't check once a month in the way that I now try and raise awareness for others to do. I also think I had a habit of checking myself in the bath, and actually because my tumour was very deep and I've got sort of big boobs, and because it was almost on the chest wall, it was actually very hard to feel when I was lying in the bath. So I've learned a lot really since diagnosis of I can still feel it now because the scar tissue is still there, but I have to be in a certain position to be able to feel it.
That's so really important, isn't it, that actually people do realise that when you do your breast check, you should do it both lying down and standing up, but arms above your head, looking in a mirror. There's so many ways of doing it.
Yes.
Where it's not just the quick, feel, is it? It's much more. And were you aware of sort of breast cancer? Had you had friends with it? Was there family members with it?
I was certainly aware of breast cancer through my work. Yes, I had had friends with primary breast cancer. I had an aunt with breast cancer, but I had no knowledge really of secondary breast cancer.
Okay. And what happened when you obviously got seen by your GP? Did they refer you onto the hospital straight away?
Yep, so I was referred straight in. 2 weeks, I think, until I had my appointment, which is the longest, most hellish wait that there can be. And I know that I hear that it's even longer sometimes now, which, you know, must be just awful because, that's just so hard. But yes, went in after 2 weeks, went into the appointment by myself.
Okay, is that because of COVID?
Because of COVID. And I think it was the first appointment when you don't officially get told you've got breast cancer. So Nigel was waiting for me in the car. Again, I felt I could read the consultants.
Okay. So they didn't say the words breast cancer, but you knew that it...
Not initially, but once I then went, had the ultrasound, and the biopsy, I had a lymph node biopsied and the lump biopsied, went back to see the consultant, and he pretty much told me that it was cancer. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I was on my own, and I was just... devastated. But obviously then the plan was to then have chemotherapy first because of the tumor being potentially by the chest wall. He wasn't sure if it was actually on it. So the plan was to have an MRI breast and a CT, have 6 months of chemo, and then go back to him for surgery and radiotherapy and hopefully have the cancer cured.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back in probably about a week for the results of the biopsies. It was a grade 2, stage 3 cancer at that stage. The lymph node was positive too. I think the same day, actually, the same day he'd arranged for me to go straight down to oncology and meet my oncologist and talk about the chemo, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down to that appointment. It was a good appointment, and Nigel was with me. And
that was good.
Yep. And we made another appointment to come back after the CT and to consent for the chemo and then start the chemo the following week. Now, 6 months before, so really from in the January before I found the lump, I'd had hip pain.
Right.
I'd been to the GP. They'd thought it was a bursitis. I actually did push for an x-ray. So I had an x-ray of the hip, which they said was clear, just showed a little bit of early arthritis, but nothing, nothing significant. I had a little bit of physio. She felt it was coming from my back rather than my hip, but the pain never went away. And now that I really know the red flags, the pain was worse at night. It was quite excruciating.
Was it constant?
No, it wasn't constant. It came and went, but it was very severe. And like I say, in the evenings, some evenings I would struggle to even get up the stairs.
Mm. And can I ask, when you had your initial discussions and appointments, did they ask, and is it normal for them to ask for these red flag symptoms? And talk about.
Do you mean, do they sort of say to you, do you have any other pain?
Yeah, pain anywhere, bone pain.
No, absolutely not.
Because we've had quite a few women now who have had their secondaries missed in that initial workup.
Yeah, I also think there is this case of it's very easy to not remember. Like, you know, you've had that pain, but it doesn't really, to you, maybe relate. It could be anything.
Hindsight is a wonderful thing, I
Precisely.
Guess.
And I think actually it is a case of, maybe there should be a form that you fill in that says something like, you know, how's your sleep been? Do you have any pain? Have you been coughing? Have you got any headaches? So that the doctor can kind of, you can do it in your own time, maybe not in an appointment where you're a bit overwhelmed with it anyway, but so they can actually read it and say, okay, this woman's been having for 6 months this issue, or for 3 years this issue. And it might not be relevant, but it might then give them that option to then look into and investigate further. Because as we say, the amount of people that get put into a cycle of either chemotherapy or just surgery
without having investigations to look elsewhere.
And I believe if I was having things the other way around, if I was having surgery first, I believe I would have had the surgery. If my tumour had been smaller, I would have had the surgery, and I wouldn't have had the CT until after surgery, pre-chemo. So it was only when I went for the when I was at the appointment discussing the chemo that I mentioned to the oncologist that I'd had some hip pain. So I remember her saying, you know, let's do a bone scan just to be sure. It's probably not, but let's do a bone scan.
And you say you weren't aware of secondaries at this point, and what it was.
Wasn't on your radar.
I was aware that people got secondary breast cancer, but and at that stage, was I thinking it? Maybe slightly, because I was worried. I was suddenly thinking, I've had this pain for 6 months now and it's not got better.
So
if anything, it's getting worse. I was spending a lot of time. It was, you know, COVID times. We were inside. I was Googling and scrolling lots and lots about all the different stages, you know, of cancer, etc. So maybe, but certainly prior to that, with the hip pain, never crossed my mind, obviously, in a million years, that because cancer wasn't on my, you know, on my radar at that stage.
And why would it be? That's the thing.
Yeah.
So you then had this scan?
So I had the scans, and 2 days before I was due to go back to consent for chemo, I got the dreaded no caller ID phone call on the home phone.
I hate those.
On the home phone.
You never get a message left. If you don't answer it, you never get the message left to say who actually called you, then you don't know what department.
No.
Yep.
I was on my own at home. I don't know where everybody was. And I got the call from the receptionist to say, could I come in? And my oncologist wanted to see me, and could I be there in the next hour?
Oh, wow.
Okay, so quite quick.
Mm. So
no panic.
No,
no stress.
No panic.
Nothing.
I don't actually know how I got myself to hospital.
You took yourself?
I did take myself. Wow. Yeah. You know, convinced myself by the time I got there, it was, you know, I was going to be given extremely, you know, bad news that, you know, the cancer had spread everywhere. That's what I believed I'd been called in so quickly for. And Nigel met me there, and Nigel came in, thank goodness. And that was when I was told that the CT had shown a tumour in the middle of my spine and a tumour in the iliac bone.
So you didn't have any back pain?
No back pain. Only, strangely, once I knew it was there, if I pressed, because it's under the bra strap, if I pressed, I could feel like a burning sensation.
Okay.
But I hadn't had back pain before.
And you probably don't normally press your spine.
No,
do you
don't. No, it's funny because I do now. I go from top to bottom, just giving myself a little check. But
how did you feel in that moment?
Explain. Oh, gosh, devastated, and completely blindsided by what she just said. I don't think I really heard that much apart from that it was incurable. You know, and Nigel was obviously crying, I was crying, but the main concern that day was that the tumour on my spine was causing spinal cord compression. So there was the reason why she'd called me in so suddenly. She'd booked me straight in for an MRI that afternoon, and so I had an MRI and then spent the longest 24 hours of my life on bed rest at home waiting to find out, and trying to process some of what I'd been told, whether I would need surgery or radiotherapy.
Spinal cord compression is a medical emergency.
Yes, which was why I was called in. Yep. You know, I now understand that. So that was kind of the real focus of the appointment, really, then. Of course, she explained, you know, what the situation was and where the cancer was. Mm-hmm. You know, she tried to, you know, reassure me that it was very low volume cancer, and that, you know, I do remember her saying, you know, that some women live for a good number of years. So there was, but I didn't, it was predominantly, it was incurable cancer, and I was not expecting to hear that day.
And I think there's still a lack of awareness these days of, I think people still have this older view that to be told you've got secondary cancer and it's metastasized, especially to the bones, people immediately think the next conversation is going to be, how long do I have left?
Yes.
And there's still this lack of understanding that actually, especially with breast cancer, there are so many drugs now that it's not immediately straight to a terminal conversation.
Yeah.
And it's also very unknown depending on how your body responds, doesn't
yes.
it? So it's very
individual.
Everybody's drug regime will be different. It's very, you can't really compare yourself to anyone 100%, because even if the same person has been diagnosed on the same day with the same type of cancer, their body will react differently to the drugs potentially.
Definitely.
Did you know anyone that you could reach out to at that point, or how did you sort of cope with you know, friends and family and telling people?
It was really, really hard because of COVID. I remember walking out and seeing the Macmillan door with "We Are Closed." You know, it's funny, isn't it? I can't even remember now whether you could, I don't think I could meet anyone at that stage. I don't think I could even go out. I think we were still at the, go for a couple
walk
of walks
by yourself.
With my husband. And
but not with anyone else.
Yeah, so I did have friends, and once we could meet, obviously that's, you know, I spent a lot of the next few months meeting friends for walks and chats, and that was, you know, one, it was great just to be outside. That's what I always still find really, really helps me.
Mm-hmm.
And just chatting to friends. Obviously, I've got my husband, I've got my two daughters who are both, you know, incredible, both amazing. But then, yes, I spend a lot of time online trying to find stories of people that were, you know, living well.
Hope,
yes, yeah, exactly, hope. And just people going through the same situation, because you feel like, you know, I'm the only person this devastating diagnosis has been given to. And then quite quickly you realise that there is a whole, you know, community of people that have been, you know, been through that diagnosis and are living with that diagnosis. So yeah, it took me a while because I wasn't actually that social media sort of savvy. I had a Facebook page, but I found then through Instagram. I mean, one of my first friends that I found was through Secondary Sisters website. It was Jeannie. I don't know if I'm allowed to say it.
Yeah, of course you are.
And she posted her story on there. And I'd commented because she was being treated at a hospital near to me. And it took her a while, because I think she posted it a while ago. Mm-hmm. So it took her a while to see my comment. And then we got in touch and it was just so wonderful to have not just a friend that was going through the same thing as me, but someone that I would have been friends with anyway.
Well, she's also got a similar age. She's got children similar age.
Yeah. And we have the same oncologist that were at the same hospital. So there was lots of sort of things that we sort of connected on. And
that's amazing to hear that you found that off the secondary page.
Yeah. Just quickly going back to your point about when you hear that you've got secondaries in your bones and you think, even as a nurse, with my knowledge, I'd worked in oncology as a nurse when I was in my 20s, and that's what I thought, because that was often mm-hmm. the case mm-hmm. when we went back 20, 30 years ago. Secondaries to the bones, you know, was a very, very poor diagnosis.
Yeah.
So it was really good to get the information and to see, you know, you and lovely Nikki living your lives and thinking, you know what, there is hope mm-hmm. to live a good life. And so I found it on through social media, and I, as the years go on and you're living with it, you make more and more connections and
I think it's that, you know, they say live a new life, but it's still did you find you were grieving for your old life? Did you find that you had to change quite a bit as a person? Like, how did you cope with that transition?
I definitely grieved for my old life and grieved for the future that I thought I wasn't going to have. I feel like I went through most of the emotions that you would go through with grief. Mm-hmm. I think anger was the hardest one, because I was angry in that first year. I had quite a lot of anger, and I think, you know, when I look back, I think that was the hardest one for Nigel to live with, you know, when you are angry. And I just felt just incredibly sad, just really sad, really frightened.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
And it did take me, probably a year to come through that grieving process.
It's important to highlight actually that, you know, yes, people like myself and Nikki, for example, were showing quite a positive life on cancer, but we have also been through that.
Yeah.
You know, we did go through those dark days. We did have to, you know, navigate the turmoil that you kind of get after a diagnosis. It wasn't like walking out of the appointment happy and skipping. It was a lot. So actually people say sometimes, you know, how can you be so positive? And it's like, because we've gone through those processes of grief, and it's really important that you allow that.
Yeah, and I actually remember, I mean, you won't remember because I'm sure you get millions of messages, but I actually messaged you or messaged Secondary Sisters, and I remember you saying in the message, you know, it took you about a year.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, that was really helpful because you worry that you're wasting life. I was kind of having this balance where, you know, I can't keep being, you know, I can't keep grieving and sad. You know, if I've only got so long, I want to be living and enjoying life. So it was a tough year.
Mm-hmm. And what was the plan for treatment at that point? So obviously you'd been told you're going to have chemotherapy and, you know, thoughts of losing your hair. Suddenly the plan for treatment had obviously changed because you were a de novo diagnosis, which went straight away to secondaries. What happened with the treatment? What was the plan then?
So when I went in for the appointment, after I'd had the MRI and the decision was that I'd have radiotherapy. I didn't need surgery, thankfully, to the spine. So I had radiotherapy to the spine and to the hip. Which, you know, I had a really good response to, which was great. But I expected to walk in and still be having that treatment, to be having chemotherapy. I didn't realise the plan would change.
Right, yeah.
And I initially felt, gosh, I'm being really given up on as a stage four patient. They're not giving me chemo and they're just going to give me some tablets. And, you know, that's how I felt, you know, because I just didn't understand. But I do understand now, and the treatment has been very effective. So I'm on ribociclib, letrozole, and I have dizunamab injections, which is to help with the bones, to hopefully prevent spreading the bones.
Mm-hmm. So for people listening, these are drugs that are focused on stopping the spread, shrinking if possible, and keeping it at bay.
Yes, and my cancer was very strongly estrogen and progesterone positive. Mm-hmm. At the time I was diagnosed, I was told I was HER2 negative. Mm-hmm. However, now with the new grading, I am HER2 low.
Okay. So there's been a lot of discussion in the media recently about a drug called Enhertu that is for HER2 positive patients. So people like myself have access to it. But actually at the moment, there has been discussions around it being available for HER2 low. And it's actually been proven to work, and it's available in so many places, but there's been a lot of talk around it because England haven't accepted it yet on the NHS. Like, how do you feel about that in the sense of, obviously, you know, it might be a line that you could potentially have?
I mean, I was devastated like everyone else when I heard that the NICE had refused access again to it. Really devastated. It is a lifeline. Some people need it today. Some people will need it tomorrow. Some people haven't even been diagnosed yet will need that drug. And I'm just really hopeful that with all the social media work that's going on in the background, I do some work with breast cancer now. I'm hoping that things will change, that it'll get, you know, the petition is really doing well now, isn't it? It's going to go to Parliament.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's a lifeline for so many people. It's hope, isn't it?
How do you find the treatment you're on currently? How does it affect your lifestyle, side effects? Like what does it give you that maybe you didn't have before, and how do you cope with it?
So I'm very lucky. I'm still on my first line treatment. And things have been, you know, stable and responded really well to it. So I'm 3 years, 9 months, I think, now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, I think I had more side effects in the beginning than I do have now. Or maybe I've learned to manage them. I don't know. I get more tired probably in that last week of the cycle. Mm-hmm. So I notice I'm more tired then. Probably my worst side effects on my joints. Stiff joints. I've had some issues with my knee. It doesn't stop me, my mobility, but it stops me walking long distances, etc. Yeah, they are the main side effects, but I generally live very well, and I know I'm very lucky to do that, but I do live very well.
How do you find the menopausal sides? Because obviously having drugs to remove the estrogen of your body changes things.
Yeah.
Were you in menopause naturally anyway, or is this something that medically changed you?
Yeah, so I wasn't, you know, definitely not in menopause. Mm-hmm. I had a condition called adenomyosis,
which is similar
to endometriosis and causes really severe pain and heavy bleeding. So I had that before I was diagnosed. So I had a long history of very, very painful periods, very bad PMT. So I am one of the few people that actually, when I was put into a medically induced menopause, I felt better overnight.
Okay, wow.
Amen to that. I've said this before in other interviews that, you know, for someone who's got a condition that having periods and having those cyclical hormones makes it worse and puts you in chronic pain.
Yeah.
Actually, the side effects of menopause are nothing in comparison.
No.
Did you find a relief from not having the pain?
A huge relief. And I felt level for the first time in many, many years. And the hot flush, the hot flushes, I kind of lived with them. Yeah. I don't think they were as severe as some people had, actually. And they've actually stopped for me now. But I've actually, so I had Zoladex for 3 years.
Okay.
But I became resistant to the Zoladex. So the symptoms came back of the adenomyosis. So a week before my next Zoladex was due, I would start to get the pain again. And it was really horrible. I had a really sort of tough few months before I was kind of listened to and referred quite urgently then to have my ovaries removed. So I had those removed last November and, I feel good again.
And with the Zoladex, just because you're a nurse, did you do it them yourself?
Oh, no, I wish I had.
Because I opted to.
Yeah.
They trained us so that we could I could administer it myself. So that is a horrible...
I was going to say, for those that don't know what Zoladex is, it's a hormonal implant that gets put into the tummy area and it sort of stops your body producing oestrogen. But it is
a massive...
It's like a hole punch.
It is a hole punch, like an apple core.
Every 4 weeks you have to have it.
I used to do it myself.
Yeah.
It hurts so much.
If you think if you've got a phobia of needles, don't get needles.
There's a hole. I did used to numb mine. I used to use Emla, so I could never... I think if you were giving it yourself, that would help.
Yeah.
There's literally a visible hole after it's gone in, though, isn't there? There's literally a hole in your stomach after it's gone in.
I did have on my very, very first Zoladex when I ever had it. I got home and I took the plaster off. And there was a little bit of the implant sticking out.
I had
to go back the next day and to pull it out and redo it. I don't know. It's never done it since. I don't know how that happened. But because it was the first one, I was like, because I didn't know how long it was. So I was trying to like push it in.
It's squeamish.
Sorry for anyone that's got
the
screaming.
With the menopause, there's a lot of discussion at the minute in the media about menopause. And, you know, I'm curious to get a balanced view of menopause. Do you find you get... what symptoms for menopause do you get? Because for me it's insomnia and brain fog, and I didn't realize that insomnia was related to menopause. And it was only after googling, this is the only other thing that's changed. Like, I cannot sleep. Hot flushes don't bother me, like you said, they do not bother me that much. I've got arthritis, so insomnia and brain fog. I think the same.
Definitely insomnia, which I forgot to mention that. But that becomes such a normal part of your...
You forget to say that.
But definitely insomnia. Although I have to say that's improved since I had my ovaries out, rather than Zoladex. After Zoladex, I never used to sleep for probably 3 or 4 nights.
Okay,
I was wide awake. I don't know if that was the same.
Yeah, I'm the same.
Yeah,
I struggle. But
I do still have insomnia and brain fog. Yes, definitely brain fog. I can forget what I've walked... I've walked into a room for. I can forget what I'm trying to say. I can't get the words out. The work that I do now, I don't work as a nurse now, but I still work for our business, and which, again, I'm very lucky because that's flexible work around me. I'm my own boss, so I can work it around everything else in my life. And because I do the kind of accounting side, I used to be able to do all that in a day, but I find now I'm slower and I could only focus maybe for a couple of hours at a time. And you know, that's enough. And that's definitely since menopause, you know.
So often it's quite difficult because previously you were working as a nurse and you're used to being really active. How did you find that adjustment, the fact that you couldn't go back to nursing?
So As I've said, I do still work part-time for our business, which is flexible and is really good and gives me a distraction and a focus. But no, I didn't go back to working as a nurse, but I do work on a voluntary basis for Breast Cancer Now. And I'm involved in something called the Service Pledge, which is a project that they do with different hospitals around the country, where I work as a patient advocate. And so I look at the feedback from the surveys that go out to all of the primary breast care patients and all of the secondary breast care patients, also to the staff at the hospitals. And then together we look at what we can do to change and improve services in that hospital.
That's vital, isn't it? That's such an amazing thing to be doing.
And I really, really enjoy that. And I have seen some really positive changes through doing that work. Predominantly, most of the time, the biggest thing that they actually need is a secondary breast cancer nurse.
Yeah.
And these service pledges really help to sort of put the case then to get the funding for that. So it's been really rewarding seeing that happen.
Oh, that's brilliant. Mm. That is really useful to, because when you're in a caring role for so long, and particularly when you feel you've been so negatively impacted, there's sometimes this need to help other people and turn it into something positive, paying it forward.
I feel, you know, my patient experience predominantly is what helps me. Yeah. But I've also got that background understanding of the pressures that the staff, you know, are under and the hospitals are under.
You've got the whole package, which is amazing. Yeah. Like you say, you can see it from both angles. Yeah.
And so obviously we've talked about, you know, the impact on your husband. What about your children? How did you tell the girls and how have they coped with this process? You know, obviously they're not little, they're older, so they can understand a lot more.
I think obviously when I told them, they were devastated, and without a doubt that was the hardest part of it all, the worst day of my life.
Plus it was COVID. Were you able to tell them, were they living with you?
My oldest daughter was training as a nurse, and she actually delayed the end of her training to come home.
Wow.
So she delayed the last 3 months. She came home, I can't remember where we were at then, but she isolated in a friend's barn to then come home to me. So she then came home. My other daughter was living with her boyfriend's family, but she came over. So she came over that day. We told them both, and it was, you know, obviously they were devastated. But they are both incredible. Alice is a nurse, qualified nurse now. She obviously went back. She has a good understanding of it all. And Jess, she works in community forensic mental health services. And she too has a good understanding of it. I'm just very, very proud of them both every day. They're supportive, very supportive to me. And I know they're both there if I need to talk to them. But like I've said, I don't want them to worry about me too much. Mm. They don't need to worry about me at the moment. You know, I'm doing fine. And yeah, I'm sure it's hard, but I'm very proud of how they've coped and dealt with it all.
Are you trying to keep hold of that dynamics of your mum and you're there to look after them? Are you not wanting to let it flip so that...
No, definitely. Although I would say it did switch for a short time at the beginning, and when they did look after me, and they really did, you know, so it did flip. But no, I think I remember for the first time the Christmas after, so it was sort of 6 months after, I remember starting to nag them again and thinking, hey, you know, this is how it should be. This is how
you're back.
Yeah.
Do they check their breasts because of you?
I tell them to, and I put it on my, I put it on my Instagram, feel it on the first, you know, and I believe they definitely do. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
And how do you feel? Because obviously you've not had any surgery, and you've not had any, when I say chemo, you haven't had any of the sort of harsh chemo, you lose your hair. How has that response been? Because we've spoken to a couple of ladies that, you know, found that because they hadn't lost their hair or hadn't had surgery, they felt a little bit like it was almost like they were the fraud, they were the one that hadn't got it worse. But how have you come to sort of terms with that and explaining it to like friends who maybe don't understand that you are going through something really serious, but actually you look the same?
Obviously my family and my friends, my close friends, understand what I'm living with because I've explained it to them. Mm-hmm. It's often people that are more on the periphery of your life that do not understand that how do you look so well? You know, I hear that all the time. And I'm not someone that doesn't like being told that I look well, because that's a compliment. Yeah. But when it detracts from what I'm actually living with, or when you know people say, you know, gosh, you know, you don't look like you've got cancer, and I feel, like you said, Laura, I feel that people don't understand, because I haven't lost my hair, because I do look well. I do think that it's more something in me that feels, you know, do people see me as a bit of a fraud, like you say? You know, I'm living well. I'm doing well.
But you're still dealing with such a, you know, a dreadful disease, and being part of the community, you've probably felt it yourself, but there's a lot of losses, and quickly often people seem to deteriorate. Yeah.
And absolutely, because what I know that things are going to change for me. I'm in no doubt that things will change, that I will have progression, I will need to change treatments. And instead of, I think what other people don't always understand is that the longer you go with stable scans, mm-hmm. the longer you go, if you've got a primary cancer diagnosis, the longer you go without having a recurrence, the better, you know, the better it is, isn't it? But with us, the longer you go, you feel as if your clock is ticking down.
I feel that.
And I feel my luck is going to run out.
You always feel like the next scan, it can't be stable still, because, you know, it's been that long.
And that's how we are living all the time.
Do you find your anxiety levels get high? So you're saying that now, when you have a scan or something, you are more anxious, you are more worried, you are thinking that you're closer to that point.
Definitely. And I actually think it's got worse.
Yeah,
I think the anxiety gets worse because of that.
I had this conversation with my oncologist the other day when I had my scan results, and she said to me, look, obviously you've been doing really well, we could move you to 4 monthly scans, but her response, but I know you won't want to. And I just went, no, I said 3 monthly is bad enough. And I said exactly that. I feel that I'm getting to that point where it's more likely to change.
But we know that we know through the community how quickly things can change.
Fear.
Fear, definitely. You know, we see it, we see the loss, we see, you know, people that look just like me and you, that, you know, things change all of a sudden very, very quickly. And so I'm not naive to the fact that that's going, you know, that one day that is going to be what happens to me. So, yeah, you know, that makes me nervous. When I came back from, I had a really nice holiday, but I was unwell before we went, just with a virus. Mm-hmm. And when I came back, I had some bloods, you know, just, and my liver function tests were abnormal.
Oh.
And it completely,
yeah,
you know, threw me completely, you know. And as it turned out, it was the virus that I'd had that had caused it, and it has come back down to normal now. But that's all it takes. And that's what I try to explain people. I am always just one blood test, one scan away from things changing. And that's, no matter how well we look and how well we're doing, that's the reality of what we live with.
Do you ever go to that point? Do you ever talk about your potential future and plans and, you know, funerals and wills and, you know, all these sort of discussions, or are you people that sort of tend to not?
No, we do. Yeah. We do, and we certainly have. And we have had funeral discussions. I've written things down. I haven't done a full funeral plan. I have a funeral contender songs list on Spotify that I play when I really want to get those emotions out, and have a drive around in the car and just let those things go. But we do talk about that. Since my diagnosis, we've both learned to live more for today.
Yeah,
I think we very much work to live now, and it's nice that we both do that, because I think, you know, Nigel plays more golf, so he takes more time out to do things for himself, as well as we both, you know, we spend more time doing things, living life, holidays, trips, days out, going to, you know, we just live more.
What's your favourite thing you've done since your diagnosis?
Well, it has to be our holiday to the Maldives in January.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's stunning there, isn't it?
It was incredible, and it was something that we thought we'd do when we retired, so we've just brought it forward, and that's so important to me, because it's when I die, my future. You know, I grieve for that, for the future I'm not going to have, but he's not going to have his future with me either. Mm. And so I feel it's so important to make as many memories with him now, and do the things that he wants to do too. So, you know, he just loves snorkeling. Mm. And
best place to snorkel.
Yeah, it was. And yeah. I say yes to so much more now. And I'd never snorkeled before. I actually learnt to snorkel there. I swam with sharks, which
did
is
you see
something.
All the beautiful parrotfish and the turtles?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was just incredible. And even something like going on the seaplane, believe it or not, I would have been a bit scared of 10 years ago, but just loved it. It was just incredible.
And on that note, if you could go back and say something to your younger self or to people at the beginning of their journey, what advice would you go back and give to your younger self?
I would probably say travel more. Don't sweat the big stuff so much because, you know, it really, you know, life really is too short to worry about some of the things I worried about when I was younger. You know, love your body more because we have, you know, so many body hang-ups when we're younger. Look after yourself. And I know it sounds a silly one, but I would have said get a mammogram earlier. You know, yeah. Because I do believe if I'd have had a mammogram when I was 48 or 49 or even at 50, that my story would have been different. So I am a little bit of a...
Because you demonstrated de novo, so that breast cancer was sitting there somewhere, lurking, unfound.
Yeah, yeah. And there was, I think there was a trial for a while where they did start mammograms at 47, didn't they, in the UK? And I'm not really sure. I've never actually found the energy to look at what the results of that were. But yeah, so...
Which is why educating people on breast awareness... It doesn't just start when you're in your 40s or 50s. No. Breast awareness has to start in your 20s, as soon as you've got breast tissue, and as soon as you start having periods. Know your body.
Not putting things off,
Know your body. Look after your body. Go for every screening test that there is. Go for your smear tests. You know, do all of those things.
If something's not right, get it checked, because it's far better to get it checked early than deal with it later.
Definitely.
Absolutely. Mm. And we like to end each podcast with asking about what brings you joy the first thing in the morning. So when you get out of bed, what makes you smile?
So much, really. I just think my life. I actually, you know, I love my life. I have a good life. I love everything that's in my life. Obviously, my girls, Nigel, you know, they're my reason. They always have been. So even though my girls aren't at home with me now, they, you know, they very much are a huge part of my life. And I think I know that if I'm living well and getting up and doing things, they're not worried about me. So that's important. So they're kind of the reason. I've normally got plans because that's being busy and having plans is how I, you know, that works for me.
Everyone's saying that.
It really
keep
does.
Keep yourself busy.
Keep yourself busy. It's definitely, you know, sometimes too busy and you have to slow down, but that definitely. Yeah. So I've normally, and if all else fails, I've got my dog. I've got a lovely 2-year-old lab that is, I've always got to get out of bed for, because she's waiting to get up and go for a walk. But yeah, so they are the things that get me up and going.
You should be sponsored by some kind of pet rescue, because every person has said
it's children or pets
or gardening. It seems to be the key
it's
things.
The little things
it's
not
the simple
it's
things.
Not the big things expensive no. things it's the
yeah
the
cool. And don't get, you know, don't get me wrong, there are some days when I don't want to get out of bed, and there are and I maybe, you know, I present a positive picture because I do live well, but there are hard days and dark days, and when I have them, I still have to get up and walk Bonnie, but then I go with them, because
you're allowed to have those days.
Exactly.
And I think it's so important that you...
So the main reason that I wanted to do this and be involved in this project was that if there is one person that listens to my story, who's hearing the news that they've got incurable cancer, and they find some hope in my story, in the way that I did, when I was first diagnosed, then this will be worth it.
Thank you. And that is true. We've talked about that a lot, the power of social media and being real and having the truth out there.
So connection.
That the reality of illness early in life needs to change. We need to change the narrative so that people have a realistic view and have some hope and to know where to get support and have a realistic expectation of what life can be like. So thank you. That's the epitomizes what we're doing.
Barbled it a bit there, but use whichever bit sounds best.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We've really loved getting to know you and your
thank
story.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure.
You're a lovely person. It's been great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Mortal and Strong podcast. If you want more information about today's voice or how to get support on any of the issues we've discussed today, please head to our website, www.mortalandstrong.com. And remember, click subscribe, find us on all social media platforms, and to find out ways of how to support what we are doing or more information on the project, head to our website. Thank you for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.